The following interview is between Ernst Sundel and Marsha Lederman from Q107 Radio here in Toronto, Canada, and was made on Wednesday, the 19th of January, 1994, at their studios here in Toronto, and is approximately a half an hour long.
How can you say that this didn't happen?
I don't say it didn't happen.
What do you say?
I became famous, or infamous, depending on which side of the fence you're on, by publishing a booklet called Did 6 Million Really Die? ?
Mm-hmm.
So, that already says what I'm all about. Did 6 million really die? This is a 30,000 page booklet that says no, in the end, 6 million did not die. And it gives, in those 30,000 words in an essay, the details of why no 6 million could have died.
But it's been proven over and over and over and over again that 6 million did, or 5.7 or 5.9 or 6.5 or 7.1.
A lie repeated 6 million times doesn't therefore become a truth. Let me explain it to you. In Auschwitz, there were 19 tablets in 19 languages till 1989, and it said 4 million people were murdered by the fascists here. When I went back 1 year after my trial, 1989, these 4 million suddenly had vanished to nothing. The tablets now say nothing. And now the historians are saying, oh well, maybe 1.1 or 1.6 million died here. Now, that already means that a city the size of Toronto, the population the size of Toronto, did not die. So you cannot say for 40 years that 6 million died, discover in one camp alone 2.4 million didn't die, and then say 6 million died. You cannot.
Right. Yeah. You're right. There are being adjustments of the figures, and in other places we're finding out of more deaths, and in fact we'll find out even more once the Soviet Union's borders are opened up and we find out what really happens there.
Not true.
Because we know there were a couple million deaths in the Soviet Union.
By whom? By the Soviet commissars?
No.
Killing Germans and Ukrainians and Belarusians. The victims of Stalin were largely non-Jewish.
It's not what I'm talking about. And all victims should be remembered and should be mourned.
Equally.
But that's not what we're talking about.
Equally.
Right.
Nobody should have a copyright on pain the way the Holocaust lobby tries to make their Holocaust unique. It was not.
Let me ask
it was
you something.
One Holocaust of many.
Right. Was there a plan to exterminate other people? But there was a plan to exterminate Jews.
There was not.
Yes, there was.
Dr. Raoul Hilberg made the claim in the first trial, 1985, my first trial, and he said there were Führer orders. By the time my 1988 trial came around, suddenly there were no Führer orders. Suddenly it was verbal.
Eichmann admitted it.
Eichmann was kidnapped, kept in solitary confinement in Israel, was given only material by the Israelis that they wanted him to have, and you can take a floppy disk out of a computer just like you can take the memory out of a mind and replace it with another memory. Eichmann, and I've studied, it came up during my trial, Eichmann was so confused what he saw or what he didn't see, and his famous statement that a German traitor had delivered to the Allies in Switzerland that 6 million Jews were killed was done when the traitor says Eichmann was intoxicated on cheap Hungarian wine. Therefore, do we take the testimony of a highly intoxicated drunk as being evidence for some historical crime?
He was not drunk.
The man who got the figure and on whom this worldwide vilification of the Germans is based, said he was drunk.
Who?
He was a German officer.
Right. Maybe he has a bit of a bias. Maybe he has a bias just like you do in writing that you have among your friends and supporters thousands of Hasidic Jews. Come on, that's crazy. Oh, thousands of Hasidic Jews are your supporters.
Sure.
You're crazy, that's not true.
They support the same thesis. I have a rabbi on my mailing list that teaches in a yeshiva school in New York City. He comes to visit me regularly. During my very trial, 1988, I had a rabbinical scholar called Joseph Ginsburg who testified for 2.5 hours. I have made a film in Auschwitz with a Holocaust revisionist, a young Jew, 23-year-old, David Cole.
Yes, I know.
So there you go.
The point that I'm trying to make.
In other words, what I have to have is not just Jewish revisionist friends and people who agree with me. I have to bring to you and to the media generally and to the Holocaust lobby people who please them. In other words, it's not good enough that I have Jewish friends. I have to have Jews who are acceptable to the Holocaust lobby. Well, my friends and my Jewish friends are not.
No,
they don't believe in it either.
I don't care who your friends are. I'm just saying, in this pamphlet, which I've read, the things that you come out with are very selective. You quote certain people and you quote certain court cases, but then you don't quote the cases and the people and the studies that have refuted all the things that are in here. So I think you're being a little selective, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's because you have a predisposition. You have come to this with a preconceived notion, and your preconceived notion is?
Marsha, there are over 100,000 books written on the theme of the Holocaust. That would mean hundreds of millions of pages. Like all writers, like all radio producers, like you yourself in your profession, you are selective to put something into the story that fits you. I bet you once these microphones are shut down, you're going to take out of our interview today something that fits into your particular story the way you like it. That's your privilege to do it. And it was my privilege to actually produce this booklet. And if you have noticed, I did not write the booklet. I reprinted the booklet. And I was not allowed by the publisher to change one word. Therefore, there are only 3 pages by me, the introduction and the afterthought.
But journalists don't manipulate their work to give
journalists manipulate their work every day.
Well,
every day. The New York Times even says in the masthead, all the news that's fit to print. So somebody already decides what's not fit to print. That's already manipulation. There is no such thing as total freedom anywhere. Not on the highway, not in the bedroom, not in the radio studios.
Do you think this is fit to print?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has already been printed in 18 languages. It is an international bestseller, thanks to my trial. More words have been written about this booklet than I think anything else in the English language in modern times. Millions and millions of booklets, TV specials. 33 hours of primetime TV newscasts we monitored during my trials were as a result of this booklet. Fantastic.
The trial was good publicity, huh?
It certainly got my message across. I convinced millions and millions of people, 80 million Americans no longer believe the Holocaust happened, according to a study by the American Jewish Committee.
How does that make you feel?
Wonderful. Truth will set us free, Jew and Gentile.
You just told me before that you didn't say the Holocaust didn't happen.
That's
about
right.
Your argument.
The Holocaust, well, these Americans were asked, do you think the Holocaust happened? 22% said, no, they didn't. 12% said, some aspects are exaggerated. So 1/3 of the population of America does not believe in all or some of the Holocaust.
Let's say, how many Jews do you think were killed? What's your
were killed?
Were murdered?
Very few. How many Jews died? Through typhus, starvation,
gas
bombing,
chambers.
No gas chambers. There are no gas chambers for killing people. Well, that's what you say.
Well, it's been proven.
But proven by what? The testimony of people with fanciful memories, collective fancies.
People.
I sent an engineer who specializes in the upkeep of gas chambers to Auschwitz. He brought back 33 samples.
What was
and
his name?
Mr. Leuchter. And you,
right, the engineer who has a BA in history.
So what?
The engineer whose testimony was thrown out of your trial.
He was
How
not,
is he an engineer?
I beg your pardon. I think that you ought to correct that. He was accepted by Judge Thomas as an expert witness. The Jewish news notwithstanding and anybody else. You see, if you go to the transcript, you will find that Fred Leuchter was accepted as an expert witness in my court case to give testimony on deconstruction and upkeep of gas chambers.
No, he wasn't.
Yes, he was.
Thrown out.
No. We will establish that in a few minutes, and I'll show you exactly on what page in the transcripts that you can find it.
Right, okay.
Okay, so no.
But tell me, how is he an engineer if he has a BA in history?
What difference does it make in America? If you have practiced the art of engineering, call him a technician.
So if you put a Band-Aid on someone, are they a doctor?
No. The importance of his testimony is not that he is an engineer. That's a red herring that you're trying to introduce into the discussion. The fact is he came back with 33 soil samples from the walls, the ceilings, and the drains of these alleged gas chambers, gave it to a professor that was for 10 years the senior professor at, I think it was Princeton, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. James Roth. We brought Dr. James Roth up at the request of the prosecution and the judge, and he testified to the non-existence of these traces in these alleged gas chambers. So Dr. Roth certainly was a bona fide professor who was had run the samples in the United States. So forget Leuchter, if you don't like Leuchter.
Leuchter's report was not accepted in your trial.
The report is something else. It was accepted as a lettered exhibit. But Leuchter gave, for over almost a day, gave testimony under cross-examination. He was accepted as an expert witness. The report was not accepted, but only as a lettered exhibit. The lettered exhibit is very important because it went to the appeal court.
Right. I don't want to get
mired
in this, but by the way, Jean-Claude Pressac has written a report.
So your pharmacist is a better, your pharmacist in France is a better witness than my American technologist, gas chamber upkeeper?
Well, all I'm saying is you're stretching the truth when you call an engineer.
In America, he can call himself an engineer. Garbage men are called sanitary engineers.
Fine.
What the heck?
I don't want to get mired in this. What about all the people, many of whom I've spoken with,
right,
who've seen the bodies, who took the bodies
all
from
of
the gas
whom?
Chamber to the crematoria?
All of whom are living proof that there was no genocide, because there wouldn't be one single one around to testify to you. This is the only crime in history, Marsha, where we are trying to prove genocide through living eyewitnesses. It's a total contradiction in terms. Every Jewish survivor is living proof the Germans had no genocidal policy.
Right, so about 200,000 survived and about 6 million were killed.
Even
if 1 million were killed.
The German government has paid 4,308,000 pension claims. 40% of these pension claims. 40% of these pension claimants lived in Israel. Now, you're not going to tell me that there is 2 million Germans living in Israel. These were Jewish people. You can go to Skokie. You can go to Forest Hill. You can go to Johannesburg. You can go to Rio de Janeiro. Everywhere there are large survival organizations, all of them living proof, all of them drawing pensions in one way or another that the Germans did not exterminate them.
All of whom, whose parents, whose grandparents, whose little sisters and little brothers and aunts and uncles and cousins were exterminated.
Absolutely untrue.
It's true.
Well, that's what you say, and I say to you, prove it.
But
prove it.
It's been proven. It doesn't have to be proven.
It has to be proven, certainly.
It has been.
Of course, it has to be proven.
It has been.
Well, I have proven to the contrary. I say to you, there are 4,308,000 pension claims, 40%
of
these.
Who cares?
This is living proof that these people did not die, because we started with a finite number of Jews during the censuses in Europe. We went through all that.
Right, you didn't finish the job, and Eichmann lamented that fact when he was on trial. He was so sorry that he didn't finish the job.
So the Israeli system, press, whatever, said. Are the Israelis suddenly beyond reproach? Have they never ever engaged in hyperbole or propaganda to suit their purposes? Come on, don't be so naive.
So you're saying the Israeli reporters made up what he said?
The Israelis had this man in their clutches. When in the Somali war, Saddam Hussein, in the Kuwaiti war, so were Stalin's short trials, where all kinds of Jewish individuals confessed to the most hideous mass murders. The Slansky trials in Czechoslovakia, there were two Jews.
Okay.
They confessed to the most hideous crimes. Everybody knows it
track.
Was a lie. No, I'm not. I'm proving the point that the fact that anything is televised and that people confess something in public is no proof. We were so worried by pilots who were shot down in Kuwait and in Vietnam and in Korea, on television, saying things against the Americans that the Americans would not give them credence for 1 minute, because they said they have been there clutches for what? One week, one day,
so
3 days?
So are you saying that the Jews are liars?
Of course, many of them are.
Yeah. Why?
Sure.
Why do they lie?
Because
they
have got financial gain. They hide behind the shield of the Holocaust. At one time, the Israeli state budget was relying to a very great extent on German guilt payments, which the Quislings in Germany pay to the state of Israel. Yeah, you shake your head, you don't know your history. That's the problem.
I know my history, trust me.
Israel is a German miracle in the desert. With German money, Israeli cleverness and Palestinian sweat.
Okay, I know you. I know your feelings about Israel. I understand how you feel about Israel.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
You have never asked me about it.
I know how you feel.
I've been to Israel and I liked it.
Oh, good.
I liked it, yeah.
I'm so glad.
Sakras are totally different from Jews who are living in the diaspora, may I say.
Right.
They're not as hung up and not so angst-driven as you people are over here. Sakras are much more open, much more outgoing, much more honest. You can discuss with the Sakra the Holocaust without getting all this emotionalism.
What do you mean, you people?
You, yourself. You're a Canadian Jew. You're as hyper as all these diaspora media Jews over here.
I'm hyper.
Of course
I'm just
you are.
Having an argument, a debate with you.
Well, of course. It's pretty emotional debate. There
so
you go, Marsha.
Anyways,
okay, let's go on with that. As far as I'm concerned, you people cannot discuss the Holocaust rationally because you are totally zombified and brainwashed.
Should you be able to publish this? Should you be able to say whatever
of course.
You want? You know that there are certain things I'm not allowed to have you say on the radio. Should you be allowed to be saying whatever
no,
you
I don't
want?
Believe I don't believe that we should be able to shout fire in a crowded theater. But as a German person that has been attacked in North American media and in European media, post-war media generally, I have a perfect right to respond. And if the attack is heated, then I come back in passionate counter-defense. That's as simple as that. Of course I should be, and the Supreme Court ruled, I've got the ruling with me, that under Section 2B of the Canadian Charter of Rights, a minority has a right to express any point of view that they wish, as long as it is presented peacefully, even if it was untrue or the majority does not like it. That's it. End of story. So, Bernie Farber, Karen Mock, you, Q107, anybody else cannot muscle Ernst Zündel. The highest court in the land has decided that we in Canada have now what they have in the United States, First Amendment protection. Little people, victims, can finally squawk back against the big boys. And I am one little people talking back against the big media.
You can still be charged with hate mongering.
The Canadian Jewish leadership tried 2 days after I won my court case in Ottawa. They went to the police in Toronto. They tried to press charges. The police investigated me. Provincial police, Sergeant Matthews, after an exhaustive investigation, once again, of everything that I uttered and everything that I wrote, said that I was not in contravention of the hate law. I'm extremely careful. I'm not a hateful man. I'm not a hate monger. I'm a truth monger that tells some uncomfortable truths that irk some people because they have a vested interest in the Holocaust. The Holocaust to them has become an industry. They live off it. The chief rabbi of England, Jacobowitz, now retired, said that the Holocaust has become an industry where many people feed off, novelists, filmmakers, writers, and so on.
Getting back to the hate mongering thing,
mm-hmm.
you have not been charged.
That's
you
right.
could be charged with some of the things you say, possibly, you never know.
I doubt that very much, because I'm extremely careful, and I'm not a man who hates.
Do you like Jews?
Many of them I do, yeah, I do.
But in general?
In general, I Jews to me are like any other ethnic group, unlike some Jews in the media who think they are the apple of the eye of God. Jews to me are just very ordinary people that have a little psychological imbalance when it comes to the Holocaust, basically because they are brainwashed and victims. I will set the Jews and the Gentiles free with my truth propaganda.
Now, the survivors, I've talked, as I said, with many, and I've heard their stories, pretty mm-hmm. horrible stories. They are unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
They did happen.
I know
they did.
They're unbelievable at the one time, and then they are...
No, it's unbelievable
I
that
see.
Anyone could do this,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, it
mm-hmm.
happened. So, tell me, are these people lying?
Fantasizing. Mass psychosis. I have one article at Toronto Star, not very long before Christmas, where a fellow said that he felt sorry that people, when he's a Jew, and he wasn't in one of the glamour camps, so he felt a little hurt because he was not in Auschwitz or in Treblinka or in Majdanek. So his suffering counted for not as much as those who were in Auschwitz. It's interesting. Virtually every survivor I have encountered on talk shows, television or radio talk shows, they always met Mengele. They all met Mengele. That Mengele guy must have been in every camp for 6 years, and appeared like Christ to all these Jewish survivors.
None of the people I've met have met Mengele. Wouldn't be around.
You talk to low-level survivors. That's your problem, you see.
Low-level survivors?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Obviously, if they didn't meet Mengele, they're not high-level survivors.
I see.
Right.
So Auschwitz is a glamour camp. What went on at Auschwitz, according to you?
I just got a book called Resistance by a Polish former inmate of the Auschwitz camp, in which he said they had, at the request of the inmates, not the Fiendish Germans, at the request of the inmates, a 120-member symphony orchestra. They had a jazz band. They had a dance band.
So they were dancing and hearing music.
Well, this book is available to you, called Resistance. Get it in the library. And they had the same kind. They had a fantastic library. They had a bordello where inmates, male inmates, when they had sexual needs, they could go there and get those needs looked after. They could get ice cream or cake if they worked overtime and get special coupons. They had a wonderful library there. They had cultural events there.
Ice cream and cake. The woman I just spoke to yesterday told me she was given water with bugs and grass and glass in it.
That's pretty good. You know, one of the witnesses in my case, he had horse manure to eat in his soup. And old boots.
So they're lying.
Well, if you believe that, it'll say far more about your state of mind than my state of mind. Because if anybody can sell you on this, they can sell you Brooklyn Bridge.
Funny, my mother sold me on this.
Is that right? Did she eat the glass?
No, she didn't.
Oh, well, there you go. The mother was clever, she spat the glass out, right? It's just crap. It's beneath discussion. It's beneath discussion.
You're right, it is crap.
Yeah, that's right.
Is this an issue of free speech?
Of course it's an issue of free speech. Why should the liars, since 1945, have a license to spew forth their hatred and ethnic stereotyping of Germans unchallenged? I challenge the liars of yesterday with truth.
Should you be allowed to say whatever you want?
No, of course not. And I don't say everything that I want. I don't. I do practice self-censorship because my mother raised me as a nice, gentle truth teller.
What's your motivation in saying the Holocaust didn't happen?
To set the world free from the most gigantic hoax that was ever perpetrated on the planet Earth. For cool, cash, profit, and political power. Nothing to do with individual people suffering. The people who suffered and who are still alive were compensated by the Germans. The Germans paid 4,308,000 pension claims. 99.8% of all indemnities were paid to individual survivors and to the state of Israel.
Right, and if you
so we have settled that score.
And if you've been beaten and lost all your family and lost your childhood or your youth or your ability to have children, or you've had health problems the rest of your life because you were marched for miles and miles and miles and miles with no shoes on, you shouldn't be compensated?
I brought you a book called An Eye for an Eye by a Jewish author called John Sack. It was on 60 Minutes, the famous American television program. And he says right here, the untold story of Jewish revenge against Germans after 1945. 10 million German people died in the Second World War. 10 million. And we can account for the 10 million, by the way. We have the birth certificates for them. Not the death certificates, because many of them are buried somewhere in the wastelands of the East. No.
That's terrible, and I'm sorry for that. And there is documentation to show the Jewish deaths, too.
So German pain is just glossed over, doesn't account for anything, because we don't have the same influence in the media. Well, I have got news for you, young lady. We are fighting back for our dignity and for our right, because we want, this is the age of victimhood. Everybody wants to be a victim. Well, the Germans also were victims. And you're going to hear about it whether you like it or not.
But there was no plan to exterminate the Germans.
There was no plan to exterminate Jews. It is a blood libel. It's a vicious lie for you to sit in front of these microphones to say that the German government had a plan. There is no proof. Not a single documentary evidence that the German Reich had a plan to exterminate the Jews. It's pure invention.
Because Hitler learned his lesson after he exterminated all of the disabled people.
No,
he got some
I'm afraid. No, well, this is a very interesting point. Hitler, through the euthanasia program, was quite willing and quite open to remove life that they considered not worthy of living. So these were German people, some German grown-ups, some German kids and so on, and they decided to terminate their life in a very carefully controlled way, and they committed euthanasia. You know what the United Church discusses every year during their annual convention? Whether euthanasia should be allowed or not. You know what the Dutch Parliament just passed as a law?
No,
and you know who the greatest number of people that have euthanasia patients today are in Holland?
Yeah,
Jewish doctors are Dr. Cohen in Amsterdam.
The point is, if you have the right to choose whether you're going to live or die, this choice was made by someone else. This choice was not made by the people who died.
In the euthanasia program?
That is not euthanasia.
The euthanasia program will function in the same way over here. When people are, for instance, sick with AIDS, and this is what Dr. Cohen in Amsterdam is doing, he calls it a gentle death.
Right,
he helps these people die.
They make the choice. The people make
some
the choice.
Some of them.
The German government made the choice for these thousands and thousands.
So we were ahead of our time in Germany at the time.
So
and
in
the West, Hitler rescinded it, the great dictator, the monster who would never listen to his people and so on. When the churches put pressure on the German government, this vicious Nazi, goose-stepping bunch of riding crop-slashing, monocle-polishing people, he actually stopped the euthanasia program. So why should he be afraid to kill Jews in a program, and he stopped killing people with euthanasia?
Well, he stopped signing his name to death orders.
He never signed death orders. You're wrong.
He learned his lesson.
No. Look, Marsha, let's be reasonable about this. A program to exterminate 6 million people in Europe would mean mountains of coal for the burning of the bodies, for the locomotives to take them from all over Europe to Auschwitz and these places. There are no requisition numbers, there are no railroad train numbers that said we're bringing these people here, we're taking them there, in the numbers that you indicate. And all kinds of people, for instance, I had one witness during my trial, Professor Werber from University of British Columbia. He said there was only one way to get out of Auschwitz, and that was up through the chimney. It's a brazen lie. There's every day we read about Auschwitz survivors. We've got all kinds of them here in Toronto. So you could get out of Auschwitz without going up the chimney.
But all these people have fantasized what actually happened to them inside the camp.
No. What we arrive at in court cases, for instance. Have a cold, excuse me.
Okay.
In court, that's the beauty of court cases. And this is where my detractors made a big mistake, that we have tested the testimony of the survivors that appeared as witness against me in the first trial. Fanciful tales off the wall, so far out that in the second trial, you will notice not a single survivor was called to testify. Because they made themselves the laughingstock, like the one Polish survivor who said he ate horse manure in his soup and old boots.
I know someone who drank worms.
I know German prisoners who said in American captivity they ate grass and worms. Yeah, possible.
There you go. It's possible.
Of course it's possible.
So it happened.
Maybe.
I don't want to get into this because I know the truth. And you
well,
think
you
know
you're
the
a
truth.
Lucky girl. Yes,
I am,
right.
Yeah. But
I envy you. Don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up.
Let's talk about Hitler for a moment. You admire him, huh?
I admire Adolf Hitler, yeah. He was a misunderstood genius that put a country that was down, out, 15 million people, unemployed, partially employed. He put it back to work and in 2 years had the place humming like a cuckoo clock. And actually, many Jews came from Poland to work in Nazi Germany. 7,000 Jews came to Nazi Germany to work there because they had stability and bread and work. So he gave work to 2 million other Europeans whose democratic governments were abject failures. No, Adolf Hitler has, like all human beings, some flaws in his characters, but he was a very misunderstood genius. He was one of the great men of the 20th century.
Was the fact that he hated Jews one of his bad characters, one of his flaws?
He had gotten to know Jews during his youth in Vienna. Some Jews he loved, some he liked, others he didn't care for. And so he said that we Gentiles were not tough enough in comparison to the Jews who lived amongst us, and therefore it would be better if the Jews had a place where they could go and we had a place where we could go. And this is why Zionism and the leaders of Zionism, like Golda Meir and Shamir, were courting with Adolf Hitler, and Golda Meir and some of her friends were in Berlin hobnobbing with the Nazis. There was very close collaboration between Nazi Germany and the early Zionist movement. And you can read that in a book called The Transfer Agreement by a Jewish writer called Edwin Black, The Transfer Agreement.
So you admire Hitler and you would like to see something like that happen here that would solve some of Canada's problems?
No, Adolf Hitler is a historical personality. But it is like Bonapartism, you know?
Okay, but
it's like
Nazism.
No, absolutely not.
You don't like that kind of
government? Philosophically, mm-hmm. Do I see many good points in National Socialism? Absolutely. Would I want for a government for Canada that was a Nazi government? Mm. You couldn't get a Nazi government off the ground here because we are ethnically far too diverse. The world has not stood still. I certainly would not want to have censorship of the press the way it was under National Socialist. Under the National Socialist regime in Germany, the time has marched on. It's a totally different world. That does not mean that many of the policies that were adopted by National Socialist Germany that were good and beneficial shouldn't be adopted.
The show went on for another 6 or 7 minutes with me defending the National Socialist regime in Germany, at least to explain it to this young Jewish woman. However, we simply ran out of tape. This was an interview that Marsha Liederman made with me on Q107 Radio, the largest rock station in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I am Ernst Zündel from another Voice of Freedom at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1. Our telephone number is 416-922-9850. Auf Wiedersehen.